Coming up on this In Contrast special, the first of 7 episodes examining American media. I'm Ilan Stavitz.
And I'm Ray Suarez.
In Contrast is a production of New England Public Radio and Quixote Productions.
If we go on as we are, then history will take its revenge, and retribution will not limp in catching up with us. We are, to a large extent, an imitative society. If one or two or three corporations would undertake to devote just a small fraction of their advertising appropriation along the lines that I have suggested, the procedure might well grow by contagion. The economic burden would be bearable, and there might ensue a most exciting adventure. Exposure to ideas and the bringing of reality into the homes of the nation. To those who say people wouldn't look, they wouldn't be interested, they're too complacent, indifferent, and insulated, I can only reply, there is in one reporter's opinion considerable evidence against that contention. But even if they are right, what have they got to lose? Because if they are right, and this instrument is good for nothing but to entertain, amuse, and insulate, then the tube is flickering now, and we will soon see that the whole struggle is lost. This instrument can teach, it can illuminate, yes, and even it can inspire. But it can do so only to the extent that humans are determined to use it to those ends. Otherwise, it's nothing but wires and lights in a box. There is a great and perhaps decisive battle to be fought against ignorance, intolerance, and indifference. This weapon of television could be useful. Stonewall Jackson, who is generally believed to have known something about weapons, is reported to have said, "When war comes, you must draw the sword and throw away the scabbard." The trouble with television is that it is rusting in the scabbard during a battle for survival. Thank you for your patience.
That was Edward R. Murrow from a speech before the National Organization of the Radio and Television News Directors on October 15, 1958. On the 60th anniversary of Murrow's famous Wires and Lights in a Box speech, Ray Suarez and I discussed the media today. Fake. The word seems to be ubiquitous today. It is all over. It is both on the left and on the right. All news seem to be fake news, no matter who is delivering them. Fake, the word implying untrue, deceitful, maybe even farther than that, treasonous. Are all news fake news?
Well, I think we're in an age when all news is fake news to somebody, and that's part of the problem. The term, popularized by the president, has become a smothering wet blanket that you just throw over information you don't like, interpretation that you don't want to hear, events that don't fit with your worldview. You could be discussing absolutely incontrovertible facts, facts that are very much in evidence, and the president will just wave it off and say, fake news, you're fake news. So we're at a moment where that term, a term of dismissal, means I don't have to listen to you. And that puts us in dangerous territory.
But that is also because the idea of news has lost its objectivity. We no longer, as a people, believe that the news are going to be delivered in order to inform us. Instead, the word that you use is interpret. We are delivering news in order to bend that information in favor of one or of the other. And without interpretation, there is no appeal to it. Somebody has to have some sort of agenda behind it.
Well, look, it is, I think, no accident that we have been pushed into this moment where a serious adult, a serious adult who's not necessarily in the news business, just a consumer of news. A serious adult person who says, yes, I try to be aware of what's going on around me. I try to be informed about the events of the day, can simply dismiss any news that's uncomfortable, inconvenient, or contradicts a previously held view of the world. That wasn't the case before. You actually were making a declaration of unseriousness if you said, oh, I just don't believe them. But now, the left can say it of the right can say it of the left. The general audience is scratching its head and thinking, well, who is telling me the truth? And if they are telling me the truth, are they always telling me the truth?
We are such consumers of news. We are hooked 24/7, bombarded by all sorts of information coming from all sorts of sources. And the act of dismissing one portion or a particular narrative or a larger agenda is in and of itself an interesting psychological stand. You don't ignore it, you dismiss it, meaning you listen to it or you view it, you process it, and then you say it's fake. That is very different from not paying attention to it.
Absolutely.
Because what comes to mind here is the difference between a society that bans books and a society that doesn't read books. A society that bans books has chosen to put certain books out of the public eye. A society that is apathetic, that doesn't want to read books, might even be worse than a tyranny or a dictatorship, because it is the public who's making that choice.
And this is not something that is uniformly spread among American people. We have a lot of data. There's a lot of research that shows that Americans who tend to be right of center also tend to more often dismiss what comes out of the conventional news business. This is a remarkable moment. I'm teaching school now, but most of my adult life I've been trying to help the public understand the news. To see stats coming out of Pew, out of Gallup, out of reputable research firms that say a majority of Republicans, for example, in one survey, think that reporters make up facts, not bend in their interpretation, not give a selective reporting of facts that may give you a misimpression of the some weight of a story, but in fact, just make things up. Tell things into a microphone, on camera, in the words on a newspaper page that are not true, that they were just invented. That's a horrifying thought. And believe me, it would have been a lot easier to not travel, put in 16-hour days, fight for interviews. If I was going to make it up, believe me, making it up is a lot easier than what reporters actually do.
Of course, behind this whole idea of fakeness, the conception, widespread, maybe a disease that runs very deep in America today, that the news media is corrupt because there is too much money, as in politics, involved in the delivery of the news. And even though journalists and reporters and editors fight to be objective and balanced and present a viewpoint that even within and sometimes in the larger context, tries to show the other side of the story, tries to question it, the sense is that Fox News is paid by conservative forces, that CNN is underwritten by liberal forces, that the majority of people that subscribe to PBS are subscribers that have a particular ideological bent, and that money, when involved in news, dirties the objectivity of it.
There used to be a pretty impenetrable firewall between the sales side of the shop and the news side of the shop. We may have nodded to each other in the hallways, but we really didn't coordinate, talk, plan. And those old customs, those folkways of the news business, have sort of eroded. And now sales are all mixed up with content. Content is mixed up with promotion. And at a time when there's more content than ever available to the audience, and the audience is simply ignoring, walking away, rejecting what the conventional mainstream news business is putting out, then you start straining even harder to put out things that you think have a little sizzle, are sexy, are interesting, are provocative, are attractive. And this has been a problem through much of the most recent decades. But as the people who run the business see that the public is not really interested in what they're putting out, they make the mistake, instead of just gritting their teeth and saying, the public will come around, they have infused the product with entertainment values. So here's some examples. Let's say there's a big national challenge, and there's going to be hearings on Capitol Hill. The members of the majority committee in Congress have a choice. They can either ask to testify the people who are the best known people in America, who happen to take on an issue and hug it to their bosom, or the people who know the most about this issue. Which one's going to get on TV? If George Clooney comes and talks about Syrian refugees, which one's going to get on TV if the other choice is to have a Syria expert, an Arabic scholar, someone who's studied the history of Syria over the past 40 years and knows intimately the ins and outs of both the ethnic and religious makeup inside the country and the political forces inside the country? Whose hearing is going to be on television? You've got George Clooney, or you've got unknown, pointy-headed intellectual expert coming in? The values of entertainment have totally saturated the values of the news business, and in a way that ends up being not only unhealthy for the business, which we've been talking about, but unhealthy for people, because they are very well trained in those choices by now and very much understand, without even being able to specifically say, here's what I understand. But they understand that entertainment is part of news and news is part of entertainment.
How have we become, why have we become so incestuous in those two industries, the entertainment industry and the news industry, if those two industries have been there from the beginning? There was the delivery of the news, a sense that an informed population was a healthy population and that that information would bring about the right choices. Is it that we have forgotten the purpose of what is the delivery of information? Is it also that capitalism is running amok, that we need to be insatiable in being entertained even by aspects that are not meant to be entertaining?
If you were to look at the trajectory of the American news business since the earliest days of pamphlets and tracts in the 18th century, where people got their political thoughts out, whether it was the Federalists or Thomas Paine or many others, the seriousness and breadth of the news business follows the rise in literacy in the population and the rise in affluence in the population. And as the society becomes bigger, more literate to varying degrees, you get a stratification inside the business. So you get certain tabloid sheets that cater to a prurient interest about life on the frontier. You get serious insider news. Often those newspapers are quite expensive because they have very little advertising, but they are seen as essential if you want to be considered a man of importance inside your circles. Of course you're aware of the latest situation in the Crimean War. Of course you're aware that a certain ship laden with a very valuable cargo went down in a storm in the northern Atlantic. Yes, because I am a man of affairs, I understand these things, and I'm willing to pay for it. When the press starts to become popular, during a time of both tremendous interests, technological change that made it easier to get a newspaper in everybody's hand, the rise of retail, which makes advertising more important, and the rise of literacy, which means people can actually read your newspaper, you get a flowering and then a further subdivision inside the business in the late 19th century. This idea of a responsible, competitive, and thorough news business is a pretty modern idea. It's a 20th century idea for a society that much more resembles the one that we live in now, where most people can read. Most people are aware that things are happening all over a complicated world. What happened was we ended up being afraid of the audience. Instead of saying, hey, this is high fiber, low sugar sustenance. We're going to give you this because it's good for you and it's important for your overall well-being. We thought, maybe they'll go away. If we get too serious, maybe they'll go away. Maybe we've got to add some more syrup to this concoction. Maybe we've got to add some sweetener. Maybe we've got to add some celebrities. Maybe we've got to add some flash. And over time, a news business that was afraid of the audience rather than condescending to the audience rose, and now we've got what we've got. There wasn't always Entertainment Tonight. It came in the 1970s. It was a very innovative program, but it treated entertainment like news, just as news was starting to be treated like entertainment.
It seems that we had trained, or we should train, those that are within the media as having some sort of moral or ethical responsibility in knowing what is news, what ought to be given to the public. And the question becomes problematic when there is a promiscuous relationship between the media and the powers, or the media and the entertainment industry, to the degree that we erase borders. Have we forgotten what is worthy, what matters, and what is simply needed to keep people entertained and to keep people hooked?
The eternal tension inside the business is between what we think you should know and what you want to know. And we've always created products that hope to give you enough of what you want to know that you'll sit still while we give you what you should know. And I know that sounds terrible. If you've never worked in the business, you probably think, oh, God, how condescending, how paternalistic. But we in the business always were bombarded with a daily deluge of things that we could turn around and tell you, the public. We have a distilling purpose. We take this big, unintelligible glut of content, and we try to boil it down into a world that you can actually recognize and understand. And that's going to be a mix of things that you'll want to know something about and things that you ought to know something about. And we always try to get the balance right. But here's the problem. When you are afraid that we have to give you more of what you want to know in order to get you what you ought to know, things start to fall apart. Things start to loosen up. The oughts and the shoulds and the wants and all of those things get mixed up, and we lose our way as a business. I see some newscasts now that I think, my goodness, how trivial, how unbelievably trivial. Who cares? Really, who cares? Mm-hmm. And I think, wow, if I'm saying that, that's pretty bad. What must the audience be saying if I'm sitting there and saying, who cares about any of this?
And how do we become the we and the you, these two nouns that you were using? We will curate the information and you will receive it. Who is endowed? Who is responsible to shape the news? Who is the target of those news? And who is the recipient of those news? Have we changed in the way we used to present what the role, the place, the space of a journalist in American society? Are we now looking at it as everybody has a camera, everybody has a microphone, everybody has some knowledge because all of us can dispense opinion on the internet, so everybody's interviewable and everybody's a subject of fascination?
Everybody's a potential subject of somebody else's content. Everyone is a creator and distributor themselves of content. If you take pictures of a place that you've visited and something happens, you can turn around and put that on your Facebook page, which will then get liked and shared and moved along Instagram, Twitter. Then Twitter follows up and tells you, hey, I see that you put a picture on that tweet. Did you know that tweets with pictures get more traffic, more retweets? The machine itself starts to train you to interact with it in a certain way. But once we come to a world where everybody's a journalist, then nobody's a journalist. We're all just trading impressions and ideas and not very durable conclusions, day after day after day. And the idea that there is a priesthood, a guild, a group of people who actually their life's purpose and the way they make their living is figuring out, well, no, in fact, that politician, when they said that thing, they weren't telling the truth. That idea that you got from just seeing this thing, yes, the vision of it was quite effective and moving and high impact, but it hid something else that you didn't understand. The fact that that's our worldview is now just being washed away as everybody says, look, I can go out and interview people. I can put things on the web. I can have thousands of people see the things that I discuss daily. People writing blogs, people doing vlogs, people going live. I look at my Facebook feed sometimes and I see somebody says, so-and-so is going live. And I think, who cares? Right. So what? But we are a world now of content creators in a way that we weren't. And so the doors to that priesthood have been thrown open and everybody can get in on the action.
I like the term priesthood that you are presenting. I think there's a landscape that I would like to add to all this. And that is a landscape that comes from the larger philosophical questions that have shaken us as a civilization. And I'm here not only talking about the United States, but about Western civilization, maybe the world at large, since the end of the Second World War, and maybe even before that, though, the creeping relevance of relativism in life in general. We used to believe that there was one truth, sacred, indivisible, abstract, ongoing, eternal. That truth was universal, meaning everybody was at one point or another entailed to it. We have existed for 50 to 100 years now in the world of multiple idols, multiple truths competing with one another. And if a truth one has a certain appeal and value to group A, well, that is because truth B will have an equal appeal to another group, a group that may be competing with number one. And in a world where there is no centrality, in a world where there is respect and democratic openness and the conviction that we all carry within ourselves a grain of truth that will not be put down by others, that comes from the family, that comes from the tribe that we are a result of, that universe of polyvalue also spills over to the news.
Absolutely.
And you don't have it from one source because the truth that is going to be delivered in that source is very different to the other one. And thus, the questioning of the media in general as fake.
World War II ushered in a world where there were good guys and bad guys. And it was not just questionable, but almost unpatriotic to try to see the gray areas in there. The black hats wore the black hats. The white hats wore the white hats. The world was legible in that way. The Cold War ushered in a time where the country started to do some things that were not altogether admirable, but still told itself it had admirable goals. So it was sometimes mirroring the behavior of its existential enemies in order to achieve a good outcome. So, yeah, we fomented coups in countries that were trying to establish democracies. We didn't like who the democracies were electing, but we were pro-democracy. So we overthrew the governments or winked at those who would overthrow the governments in places like Iran or Guatemala or Argentina or Chile, because we were operating under some greater good. Well, the news business was immersed in that world up to its eye teeth, saw the blemishes on the white hats, and an age of questioning whether these binary truths were as neat as that. When we found out that the government had been lying to us throughout the Vietnam War about the state of that war, when we found out Richard Nixon had been lying to us about how he became president, it confirmed that not everything that you saw and not everything that the good guys held to be the truth was really the truth. Some of the good guys had bad habits and bad aspects, and some of the bad guys accomplished things that you thought, can I admire the accomplishment without admiring the bad guy? the world started to jumble up in a way that was very hard to follow and very hard to catalog in the news business and turn around and say to the people, yes, we are going to confirm your world of good guys and bad guys. At least in those days, there was some relationship to what was really happening, for real. Now, you choose a side and you stick with the side. No matter who the good guy is, no matter whether the good guy is doing bad things, it is a world that's basically just been thrown up in the air like confetti, and it's landing on the table however it lands, and the only way you make sense of it is by sticking to your guy.
It has taken me a long time, but if I ask myself why I'm here on this earth in my late 50s, I think that it is to think out loud, to think in public. It comes with all sorts of other things, teaching and writing and doing those two in a variety of ways that could unfold them into other aspects. But thinking out loud, to me, is thinking a particular point of view from many perspectives and reaching the core of it, being critical. I am frightened by how the word critical has itself become a casualty of these wars. When you are critical, you're automatically from the other side trying to bring down the opponent. But being critical, in my Socratic mind, is being able to add aspects to one single argument that will enable us to see what is the better side of that argument, or if that argument is built on sand. And my biggest fear is that in this overwhelming media that we have, where banality and superficiality reign, and where the abundance numbs the mind, that we have lost the capacity to discriminate. Another word in and of itself is a casualty, by which I mean to be able to know what matters and what doesn't matter, and to be able to think with the media and not to be in defense when we're receiving something from the media.
First, I'll say, boy, are we lucky guys that we have, through dint of our own efforts, gotten to positions where people actually would be interested in listening to what we have to say for a couple of minutes, but also that we get to think out loud for a living. It's a great privilege to help the public and work with the public and various publics to understand a very complicated world. But the pressure for simplicity is unyielding, and especially as the world gets more and more complex, the idea that when you say to people, hey, there's more to this than you realize, they don't want to hear it. They don't want to hear it because it's a bewildering world. And I get that. I walk out of the newsroom and become John Q. Citizen again, and a taxpayer and a guy who pays an electric bill and tuition bill for a last kid in college. And I live in the world immersed up to my jaw, and the world is not strange to me. I'm not part of some removed elite, and I'm often dismissed as part of an elite. Yes, I'm lucky. I don't have to work with my hands and my back the way my father and the way my grandfather did. But boy, oh boy, the idea that I am detached from the world in order to look at the world is really, really a problem. And it's very much part of this current fight over who's telling the truth, whether anybody has any obligation to believe a word I say. I just want to leave you with this, Ilan, that I could never have imagined that 42 years after walking into a newsroom to take my first paycheck, I would be at a point where I have to plead with people to believe the truth business.
Let us know what you think about this In Contrast special. Review us on Apple Podcasts or send an email to radio@nepr.net. You can also follow us on Facebook, where we invite you to share your comments on this program and others in our series. To find out more about all of our In Contrast programs, visit our website at nepr.net/In Contrast. Our music is by the Fresh Cut Orchestra. The executive producer of In Contrast is John Vosey. I'm Ilan Stavans.
And I'm Ray Suarez. Thank you for listening.
In Contrast is a production of New England Public Radio and Quixote Productions.